Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Brett and Cliff's Toy Circus. My name is Cliff.
And I'm Spooky Crabtree. I'm a paranormal investigator this week.
What's your name? Spooky Crabtree.
Spooky Crabtree.
Oh, Spooky Crabtree. Okay. I thought you said you were a Spooky Crabtree.
I could well be a Spooky Crabtree.
Well, that's what you look like. The branches are like that.
Yeah, there is actually.
It's a regular phenomenon. Yeah. What do you think of me?
Well,
t-shirt?
I should know. I think it's grey.
It's grey.
It looks rather like a works t-shirt.
I'm dressed as a cleaner from a mid-range hotel.
Is that your disguise these days?
I've actually got it's actual staff uniform.
I actually, we're both very tired tonight, aren't we? I couldn't be bothered to get changed or whatever. So I was nearly here in my work attire.
Okay.
But I did decide to get changed.
I don't actually work at this hotel, by the way.
No, you do. You do. Of course you do. You get into the vents, don't
you? But you know when you go to the hotels and you like nick shower gel, little shower gels and stuff like that.
I mean, I'd never admit it.
Some people might drug the cleaner and take their clothes before they leave. It's been known to happen.
If they're that way inclined, some people might. Still get into the vents?
Of course I get into the vents.
Yeah, you got to, haven't you?
I'm not going to get the vents in my own outfit.
No, you've got to drug the cleaner first, haven't you? It's your MO.
So yeah, I was going to say I'd be a little bit late because I just invited you to this meeting, and then as I was waiting for you to come on, I thought I'll go and do the washing up. Do you think that was a good idea?
No. Why would you do that? That's a stupid idea. Why did you? You got OCD.
Little test for myself.
What,
can I do
if
it?
You could
can
do
I do it in time? And if I come back, will he be waiting?
Yes, and you always make us wait, don't you? That's the thing with you, Cliff. You always make us wait. It's disgraceful. Absolutely.
Tweeting mean.
Keeping keys. That's what you need to do, is this? I did notice something that happened this week. Obviously, I talked about the stolen joke that Mika Richards stole last week that you gave to her. Well, you actually cut a joke out last week, right?
I didn't. It was one of yours.
You did. Okay. And Lee Hurst used it in his Twitter this week.
I'm trying to keep that quiet, man.
The only other thing, I was looking on Twitter, and a person who follows me on Twitter was putting their very life on Twitter.
What happened
this week? So I've got a couple of tweets for you, which I think you'll enjoy, because you like delving into the lives of other people, don't you, Cliff?
I do, very much so.
Now, I think this lady might expose her flesh on OnlyFans, but that's absolutely fine by me. If I could do that, I would. And I'm sure you would, wouldn't you, Cliff?
Yes, don't even know you would, OnlyFans.
So the first tweet is this, right? Going out on a date tonight, not that keen on him, but hoping he's much better company in person. What do you think of that?
I think it's a bit harsh. I also think it's mad that I presume this is a joke and not real, but I also think
it's real.
It's real. You know, like if you're dating somebody that you've met online, or you're going to meet somebody, you not think they're going to say that?
Exactly. You don't think they're following her? What's going on here? So how do you think this is going to end, this particular date? Do you think she has high hopes of it? Do you think that the man's got any chance?
I think it's probably not real, even though you're reading out what was really tweeted. And I think he probably made a play for her, but she knocked him back in the end because it wasn't really what she was after.
Right. Well, 3 hours later, the guy I went on a date with on Monday has just messaged me to say he doesn't want to meet up again. Kind of relieved, as I could see we were not going to match up sexually. But he was a laugh and a nice guy. You win some, you lose some. That's the reply there. So that's the perils of online dating, isn't it, Cliff?
Did anybody need to know either of those things?
What, the perils and the Twitter messages? Hand in hand.
Like, I'm about to go out with somebody, then 3 days later I got a message off him saying he doesn't need us. Well, I didn't want to see him anyway.
Exactly, that's it.
Okay, nobody, absolutely nobody cared.
How can you tell that you're not going to match up with anybody sexually? Surely you just get what you can take.
Also, you never know, it might surprise you. This lady might end up having sex with this man.
Right.
I'm going to say
it could be fine.
A heteronormative relationship. I'm not sure of the ins and outs or outs and outs, whatever
I think it is.
She might be like, oh, he's all right. He's a nice guy. And, you know, I would quite like some sex, even though I'm not that attracted to him. Let's see what happens. And he might surprise her. He might rear
exactly.
up and she might be pleasantly surprised.
He might have an enormous knob. Uh-huh. Now, she wouldn't know that, would she? Unless they've been doing like the pictures and stuff people do.
She wouldn't be able to tell these skills in the Cunnilingus department. Of course.
Exactly. You see, that's just like you, that, isn't it? Because everyone knows you're an expert. You don't look the next
everyone. Nobody might. Thing is, Fred, nobody would think it. We are going to get a guest on. Is a really, really good friend of mine. You've never met him before. He's a guy called Mark Dinning. Mark was I'm going to say the word mentor, even though that's a bit wanky. When I first moved out here, he came the same time. It was him who did me interview and stuff. And then he came just a couple of weeks before us, and then we were both here. So we both got used to Dubai at the same time and work at the same time. And he ended up being my boss, and he is one of the best guys I've ever met, worked for, been friends with, and certainly one of the main people who's ever helped me in my career, certainly moving into magazines, which I'd never done before I got here. But on top of that, he's a brilliant bloke, and you know, I met him, so you're going to find out. I hope you think I'm telling the truth. But what are you?
There was one mistake that you made, right? What? Because we all know that you have been in other magazines.
Haven't you? I've looked in them.
You've been in them.
I've been in looking. Yes, you're right. Before he came to work here, he was the global editorial director of Empire magazine, the film magazine, which means he's got some amazing stories about film stars and being on sets of films and stuff like that. Most of which there's no way he can tell us that we can put on this podcast because they're outrageous. But I would imagine this won't be the last time he'll be on. And hopefully he can tell us a couple of stories along the way. But he chose this week's film. I'm going to invite him in right now because he's in the room. And then we'll say hello and we'll get on with what we're going to talk about. Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Mark.
Mark, how are you doing?
Hello. Hang on, I've got a button. Hang on, there you go.
You have got a button, yes.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. Mark, this is Brett. You've never met, but meet.
Hello. Brett, nice to meet you, Mark.
Nice to meet you too. It's an honour to meet you. I've been listening to you guys since episode one, so I'm a bit nervous actually. It's great to meet you. Really great to meet you.
Oh, thanks very much. You too.
I'm sure you're not, and there's definitely no need to be.
What a lie! What a lie to start off with.
What I didn't say, I gave you a bigged you up a little bit there before you came on, not so you could hear, but you know, But what I didn't say was that Fantastic. You're the worst person at technology I've ever met in my life. So it's an absolute miracle if this works. So let's crack on before we find out.
Hey, listen, I'm on Insta now and everything.
I know.
Insta when I knew you before in Dubai.
You are, I would say you're an active Insta user.
I've never used it, mate. I don't know how to use it. Is it just pictures? Is that all it is?
Basically, yeah. It's quite stressful, actually, because you find yourself thinking, oh, I should Insta something today, which is never, not a phrase I've ever thought I'd hear myself say. But so, in fact, just don't do it. You're way better off not being on Insta.
Brett, I know every week I point out something in your backdrop, but
yes.
Has your floor
subsided? What is it this week?
What?
What's happened?
Yes, I'm currently suffering a subsidence. Yes, you're right. I'm waiting for the joiner.
Why is it wonky?
Why did you have to bring up me wonky house? Leave it alone, man.
In case you didn't realise. Right. Mark, thank you for joining us. It's a real pleasure. I know you said you're nervous, but the pleasure is definitely all ours. You just asked us to watch a film this week. You chose what we're going to talk about. Do you want to tell us what it is and why?
Yeah, sure. So this is a film it's a film called The Changeling from 1980, directed by a guy called Peter Medak. And I chose it because I think, Brett, you and I share quite similar tastes, I think, having listened to this podcast for a long time now.
Yeah.
I'm a massive Carpenter fan. I love my horror. Yeah. But there were only two movies I've ever had to fast forward through for little bits because I've been so scared. One is The Shining, and for obvious reasons, it's terrifying. And the other one is this. And it was really interesting. I'd not watched this movie for, I don't know, maybe 20 years or something before this. And I wrote a massive list of what would I want to talk about? And I remembered this. And I remember the two bits I had to fast forward through. And it was great to watch them. And I'm a big boy now, so I didn't fast forward through this stuff. But they still really gave me the willies. So if you want me to explain a little bit about it, it's a movie starring George C. Scott. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple story, really. At least it starts that way. He is a composer. His wife and child are tragically mown down on a snowy, very kind of shining-like road just outside upstate New York. And he, grieving, moves to Seattle and moves into this ridiculously massive, spooky house for a single man grieving. But the reason he does, the estate agent tells us, is because it has a music room and he's a composer. Mm-hmm. She thought it was a good fit, and he moves into this house and spooky things begin.
I think for me, I had never heard of it even. I thought you were asking us to watch an Angelina Jolie film, but it turned out not to be the case.
Thank God.
it put me in mind of The Shining. You said like they were the two films that you were a bit like scared of or that made you have the similar feelings, and the pace of it, certainly The Shining at first. I think The Shining goes off into places this one doesn't get anywhere near, but certainly the pace of it at the beginning. And I think that opening sequence with the car in the snowy road just puts you in the same position as you would be with The Shining as well. But then it goes a lot more genteel after that, which I wasn't really expecting. And, you know, like we've said a couple of times now that I was never traditionally a big horror fan. It's a genre I'm discovering anew, really. I've seen a handful of horror films. I'm learning and watching more as we go on, and I'm getting a little bit more brave every week as we watch the film. And I was surprised because I didn't find this that scary. Certainly very spooky. Certainly an eerie feeling that ran through it. And I have to admit, I had goosebumps watching a lot of the scenes as they unfolded. But there was no bit where I was kind of hands over my eyes or I was wincing a bit, which is quite unlike me. So I don't know whether that's just because it's not quite as scary as you originally remember, or I'm just a bit more used to horrors now. But Brett, what do you think?
I think very similar to you, actually, apart from the film that I got from it was actually The Exorcist. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. It was similar to. I mean, obviously, both classic horror films and stuff. But yeah, I was very similar. I think if I had have watched it when I was younger, I would have been absolutely terrified. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, really spooky, but I absolutely loved the film. I thought it was excellent. I mean, the way it's made and shot and stuff like that is just absolutely amazing. And it did remind us of like the shot sometimes in like The Shining and stuff like that, but more so the way it looked, probably because like 70s, I think it was 78 was made, and then it was released in 80 or something like that. So yeah, it was more The Exorcist for me. But yeah, excellent. The one thing I couldn't get, why couldn't he get out the phone box at the start? How can you get trapped in a phone box?
He's pushing the wrong way on it.
That's not what it is.
He's in panic. Such a flap. He's yeah. in such he's a flap. I do love the bit at the very start. So his wife's pushing the car, which will ultimately get mown down in about 2 minutes' yeah. time. And I'd not realised the line. They're having a kind of a faux argument because the car's broken down. Uh-huh. And she says, "This is the last holiday I'm ever going to go on with you." Somewhat kind of, unfortunately, it turns out to be very true. But I know what you mean. The other movie it really reminds me of is Don't Look Now, which is another movie I love.
Yeah.
Just in terms of its... Uh-huh. I guess what it is, it's obviously it's a study of grief. It's a guy grieving his lost kid and also wife in this, but also it becomes a sort of a murder mystery. He's going up, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas Donald Sutherland kind of mooches around Venice a bit and occasionally the little thing in the red map runs past. This is he's properly kind of going to investigate what's happened here, who this spectral presence is in the house, and I really like that about it.
I think that's good. I think if it wasn't for George C. Scott, this film wouldn't have the same effect. The gravitas that he brings to his performance in the film, I think by far and away he makes it for me. His performance is superb. I've read a couple of reviews, maybe our old friend Roger Ebert. A couple of contemporaneous reviews that kind of say, well, he's a bit like kind of flat. Like, why is he being like this? But he's a man numb with grief. The house, it's got about 100 rooms. Why does he need this house? But it's one of those classic things. Yeah, I mean, don't go in the basement. Don't go in the loft. Don't close that door behind you or whatever. You know, that light's not working in the basement. Well, you know what? Probably just wait until it's fixed or daylight before you go down it. It's like, here's this massively spooky house that nobody's lived here since the terrible times of whatever. And he's like, I'll take it because there's a piano in it.
Yeah.
So I think it's one of those things, but it's there for a reason. And apparently based on a true story or what somebody says was real.
That's true, apparently. The thing that I liked about it, right, I mean, obviously we've got the start and stuff like that. I like the fact whenever he wasn't in the house, so whenever he was outside, everything looked massive, right? So like it was, everything was, he was taking too much on too early type thing. So like an example of that is when he's teaching and he plays the piano because he's a famous composer or whatever. And he's teaching, he's expecting like a few students around the place or whatever. And the room is just full, massively full of students. And I think like a metaphor for like, he's taking too much on too early type thing. And whenever he's sort of, there's like exterior shots, it's like massive, absolutely huge. I think there's one in New York. Was that like famous building, the triangular type building in New York or whatever? Yeah. And it's just, it looks huge. You can see like cars going past, people walking along the street. Everything's just so huge and massive. And then when it goes into the house, everything's whoop, even though it's a big house. You know what I mean? And you get the impression that it's a big sort of area, but he's always just either sitting on the piano or talking to, you know, one of the servants or whatever, the gardener and stuff like that.
We can talk about the director a bit, like this. What a CV this man has. But what about is the cinematographer somebody famous or any stuff? Do you know anything else about the rest of the crew?
Do you know what? I don't like. So it's one of these movies where it's got a lot of very famous fans. So it's Martin Scorsese and Spielberg have both got 35 mil prints of this in their house.
Yeah.
you can see the influence of it in stuff like Alejandro Amenabar's The Others, which actually Peter Medak, the director, doesn't speak too fondly of.
No, I read a couple of bits about that. He's pretty scathing of it.
Yeah, I think it was intended as an homage to, but I think he felt it blurred the lines of homage. I think that's where he's coming from. But also people like Guillermo del Toro, and you know, they're big fans of this movie. But no, in terms of the Medak thing, I mean, his CV is best described as what, eclectic. I love how from TV he's gone from Heart to Heart, which is a show I used to love as a kid, but like literally the most innocuous show, to The Wire. Like he does these kind of like incredible kind of jumps. But he, I think, came into the movie late. I think he was the third director to come into this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that's true. You've missed out Species 2.
How could I? The craze. And Species 2 is directed, but his cinema career is very eclectic. But if you look at his TV work, he's worked on directed episodes of pretty much all the biggest TV shows or a lot of them. Hannibal, Breaking Bad, House, The Wire, even Homicide: Life on the Street, if you didn't recognize that. And Tales from the Crypt as well, which we were talking about last week.
The weird thing for me was I was watching a documentary recently about the craze. It was like a three-part documentary that was on the ITV Player or whatever. And he was on it because he did the craze as well. So he was actually talking about that, and he was like, the craze just turned up one time when he was doing a film or whatever and just went, what are you doing? What are you doing here? Have you got permission? And he was like, yeah, I've got permission. You know, I've got permission from the council and everything else. You haven't got permission from us. So the craze just turned up because they were in their manor or whatever, and they want to know what was going on. And as soon as like they found out he was a film director, he was making a film, oh, well, that's fine, because the craze were all about being famous and everything, weren't they? And the craze kind of looked after everything and took over everything. So, yeah, that was interesting.
That's great. I mean, he's a fascinating guy. Like you say, Paul, he's like, yeah, he's a Hungarian guy. But then I don't know much about it. But he's reading up on him today. He's like, so he was a first AD. So he arrived from Hungary and then he kind of worked his way up as a first, well, like a third, a second, then a first AD. But for people like, so it's Carol Reed, who obviously did The Third Man, David Lean, who we know very well, Anthony Asquith, you know, working stuff like Pygmalion. And also, just as an aside, I hadn't realised Anthony Asquith directed the movie Fanny by Gaslight, which is kind of how I used to consume pornography, but actually turns out to be a James Mason movie from 1944.
What a disappointment.
No. I take a very dim view of actions like that.
But he learned from the best. And then what was an interesting story I didn't know was that he'd actually gone for an interview with Robert Wise, who obviously famously directed The Haunting, one of the greatest ghost stories ever made. And he didn't get the gig, but he'd gone down to be interviewed on the set of The Haunting. Mm-hmm. So he kind of got told thanks, but no thanks, but then kind of hung around and got to watch him shoot a couple of scenes from The Haunting, which obviously kind of, you know, you would hope and imagine sort of inspired some of the stuff he did here. So he's got this, even though he's done like this bizarre amount of just weird, often crap movies, he's a guy who knows what he's doing, you know, and he grew up watching the best of the best. So he's a fascinating character.
I think the thing with directors sometimes is it depends what they're offered. Do you know what I mean? If nobody's offering them stuff, they've got to work, haven't they? At the end of the day, they've got to make a living and things. And I mean, I love the atmosphere of this film and like the stuff I talked about before. I think that's absolutely amazing. The story and stuff like that is great because it's like a mystery, like you said. But yeah, it depends what you're offered.
Yeah, he's moved into the house, and at 6 a.m. every morning, he's woken by this horrible banging that he just doesn't know. He has no explanation for. Is it something in the pipes? He doesn't know. And this goes on and on, and he calls in a medium. And there's a great shot. It's funny you mentioned, Brett, about how tight the shots are inside. One of my favourite shots in the movie is, so this medium arrives And she kind of straight away knows that this presence has come from the attic. Mm-hmm. So while everyone's kind of mooching around making pre-seance small talk, she heads up to the attic. And there's a beautiful shot down from where the ghost lives, mm-hmm. down at her onto the bottom stairs. And it's really tight. And she just shuts the door and goes back downstairs. And you kind of, you assume she's quite intimidated by this spirit.
Yeah.
So she begins this seance. And what's so brilliant about this, and what certainly Spielberg has spoken about. So Spielberg screened this movie to the crew when they're about to make Poltergeist. So there was a Poltergeist, obviously a very famously troubled shoot. Toby Hooper started doing it and then it went in different ways. And Spielberg became more involved or less involved, depending on who you hear. Mm-hmm. But he screened it to the crew. It's like, this is the kind of vibe I'm going for. And this was the scene that did it. And basically, so they have a seance, George C. Scott and assorted others. There's the lady who we must talk about, the lady, Trish Van Der Veer, who's so clearly fancies him from the first second she's enters the movie. It's George C. Scott and this woman who keeps turning up in jodhpurs to sort of entice him. And there's the medium's husband. And there's someone else there, but I can't remember who the other person is. But it's Trish's mum.
Yeah.
Because they meet I suppose it's a numbers thing. Is there like a minimum requirement for a seance?
Hopefully it's more than three.
You've got to create a circle of some sort. That's what I'd say.
Exactly. Otherwise they end up in a rectangle and it's just not going to work. They do this seance and the fifth spoke in this is the medium's husband whose sole job really is to feed her sheets of blank A4 paper. Mm-hmm. And the medium, the actress, and I forget her name, but who does the medium, is just extraordinary. And she sort of says, oh, you know, can you hear us? You know, talk to us, reach out. And she sort of zones totally out. And then she writes wildly with a pencil as her husband feeds her sheets of blank A4 paper. And occasionally a word will come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just kind of builds in intensity.
Yeah,
it does.
It's just really freaky. But then what makes the seance so good is that and what Spielberg has said he loves so much about it is just when you think all that's done and the seance ends and everyone goes home, you then have it happen all again as George C. Scott sits down on his own in this spooky house to listen to the recording of what happened.
And he
hears the ghost's voice on the tape as it plays.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that double kind of kicker
And you don't realize at the time, you think he's making notes, but what you find out later when Trish comes back, and that's not her character name, but when she comes back, he goes, look, I wrote down this stuff.
I think that's my favorite scene in the film, the seance bit, like the way it just ramps up and ramps up. I just love it. It's absolutely brilliant. And I love the guy sitting next to her who's just like snatching the paper away when she's finished with the drawing. Yeah. Like that.
Yeah.
I love him.
Well, here's a question, because this is something I'd not considered, and I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on it. Was so you say he's there for inspiration, etc. There's another theory that I'd never considered, but that I stumbled across online, which is that the ghost has deliberately got George C. Scott to the house, and there's even a suggestion that the ghost has killed the wife and daughter in the very first place, just to get George C. Scott there, which is something I'd never considered. I just thought this has happened and George C. Scott is here.
What's the radius of the ghost's jurisdiction?
Well, the thing is, there is a detective at one point who starts trying to put off George C. Scott from sort of investigating the centre, who I haven't really talked about yet. And he dies mysteriously in a car crash, doesn't he?
So that's fair enough.
It almost like this ghost does have external powers and can sort of affect other things, you know? So I think that's where that comes from, that, you know, possibly because the ghost has done that, then, you know, he could have drawn George Scott in. Why he would pick on good old George, I'm not too sure.
What do you think about
Wasn't there a closer composer? Because he's in New York. Couldn't you get a different one?
Just talking about the procedural thing, just quickly, because it popped into my head. What occurred to me watching it the other day was how Robert Zemeckis must have been. We mentioned all the famous directors who were influenced by it. It's so What Lies Beneath, which I also love, as a movie that Harrison Ford, Michelle Pfeiffer, is so clearly inspired by this, from the murders in the bath.
Yeah,
from the, there's a great scene with them going through all the tapes, the old newspaper cuttings in this and What Lies Beneath. And I like them both for the same reason, actually, is that they are kind of procedurals in a way. They're haunted house movies that become procedurals. But where the ghost in What Lies Beneath seems kind of satisfied by Michelle Pfeiffer's work in Solving Her Murder. This fella, he could be the monkeys. He goes mad when George C. Scott stands up. And George C. Scott, I love it. He's like, what have I got to do?
What the fuck do you want?
That is a good bit when he walks in the front door.
That seems to be the aim, doesn't it? The ghost's whole aim is to discover this conspiracy that he's being killed by his father and replaced by another person, hence the changeling, the title. He's been replaced. And George D. Scott's investigated this to appease the ghost or whatever, because he thinks that that's what he should do. But when he does eventually do that and uncover everything, the ghost just loses his shit and sets everything on fire, especially banisters. But I love that bit, because you would expect the film to go in that direction where it's, yes, everything's fine, he's done his job now, but it just goes in the complete opposite direction, doesn't it? Like, no, I'm still not happy. I'm fucking dead. I'm pissed off that I'm dead. Do you know what I mean?
It's a very convoluted plot.
I think it needs that, though. That's what I think. I think it needs it for the investigative kind of aspect of it, you know what I mean?
I know, but he goes
through a well and stuff like that.
There is needed to make people understand what's going on.
I like that side of it.
A lot to take in. Yeah. So he's killed. Yeah. This kid was a bit sick, so he killed him. But the reason he's killed him because if he died before this age, he wouldn't get the inheritance.
But talking of all of that, as much as I love this movie, this did also occur to me. Yeah, it's a massively convoluted political plot that's been hatched. I'm not quite sure how this 6-year-old boy, who's also, by the way, dead, has happened to figure this out. So he knows everything that's gone on. What is it? He's died before the doppelgangers come in. Yeah, the change.
How has he discovered it?
And the doppelganger.
Perhaps he's had the assistance of Columbo.
But the doppelganger never went to the house. So they abandoned the house and go, we've killed him up there, we've abandoned it, and we'll just start our new life when he comes back.
The thing is, ultimately, about this film, right? There's no winners whatsoever. Everybody's a loser, aren't there? Because the senator guy, he didn't ask to be plucked from an orphanage, did he? But at the end of the film, he's given a heart attack by a pitcher. No, there's no winners. George C. Scott, he investigates everything, tries to find everything out. He's almost set on fire by a banister.
I tell you what I don't understand about George C. Scott. Is that like he doesn't go fucking hell? I'll just get out of this house then, because I don't really need to be here. And my mates have already offered to put us up, so I'll just go to their house. He's like,
because Mark said, right? The lady in the jumper's coming around. I mean, why would you give that up? and you're getting inspiration for a new composition. But what do you think of George C. Scott, Mark?
I think he's great. I mean, I think he's clearly was a difficult man. I think is probably the best way to put it. But as an actor, he's incredible, obviously, like famously Oscar nominated, I don't know what, 2-3 times. Famously,
Patton, wasn't he? Yeah.
Well, he was the first actor ever to turn down the Oscar for Patton. So he didn't turn up because he thought the whole thing was I can't remember, there was a quote, he called it a meat market or something. He was like, I'm not going to that kind of thing. He clearly wasn't very nice to women. He had a big problem with drink. As a man, I think he was clearly a troubled man. As an actor, he's incredible. And I think what's kind of interesting with his performance in this is And honestly, maybe he should have overplayed it a bit more, is that presumably the reason he's staying in the house, whereas all the rest of us would have gone, thanks very much, I'll go and get another house.
Yeah.
Is because you would imagine he, if you believe that there's a possibility of life beyond death and you've just lost your beloved wife and daughter, then maybe that's why you would want to stay and investigate.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, yeah.
But the film never really goes there.
No.
And it's kind of, I think, part maybe of his performance where he's kind of gone. And by this stage in his career, I think, to be honest, he was kind of phoning it in a bit. But I don't think he is in this movie. But I think he was kind of, he was sort of underplaying stuff. You know, he was,
yeah,
he was in The Hustler before and Dr. Strangelove and Anatomy of Murder. Like, he was in amazing movies. So I think his performance, what I like about it is that his performance is so dialed back. And it's,
yeah,
and they all in Haunted House movies, they always stay in the house,
yeah,
and it's increasingly stupid. So, what I quite like about him is he stays in the house because he's not really that intimidated,
he's
by
not
it.
Bothered. That's the thing, he just gets on with it,
yeah.
And he's like, actually, yeah, I'll go and dig up another house and see if there's any ghosts in there.
The thing about him for me is, and people might argue about this, he's the greatest Scrooge. That's what I think. I fucking love that Scrooge fella.
There's only one thing for it. There's only one thing for it.
Welcome back after a little break, although you guys won't know that there was a break. So we were just talking about, basically, George C. Scott, troubled man, great performance. There was a couple of reviews that kind of said he was phoning it in. It's certainly a very dialed back performance, and I can understand some criticism of that. Certainly when you say, you know, the usual way of these characters would be to totally freak out and lose their shit, where he never does that. He just gets stuck in and trying to solve the mad mystery that is going on.
It's refreshing.
I think what I wanted to ask Mark was, after all of these years, you loved it. You were terrified of it. What did you actually think of it now that you watched it again?
Was it as terrifying as I remember it? No. I still love it. Being honest, it's very derivative from the word go, really, but it's hard, like you were saying, Brett, to figure out which came first. So when it first comes, even from the fonts, like the font is the Exorcist font. Like, I don't know who made that font, but they should be charging for it. Because it's like, oh, okay, we're in the Exorcist font mode. Although, to be fair, maybe that's why he's in Exorcist 3. Maybe they just called it in and said, listen, you've got to play off. I don't know. Although it does have that amazing shot in Exorcist 3. But I thought the jump scare. Mean, it's just
unbelievable. That. Absolutely unbelievable.
It still gives me the willies now. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. But I thought it starts a bit clunky. I still think the beginning is magnificent. It's what a way into the movie. It's an absolute kind of punch in the gut. I thought it was then very clunky when Trish turns up and she's just really quite sort of stalkery, and she just keeps saying all the time, I'm from the Historical Society. And she says to him, I've tried to get your number, but they haven't listed it yet. But anyway, I'm here now. And then she turns up the next day and goes, oh, I'm in my jumpers. So it's quite, it takes a while to get going.
Yeah.
Is it as scary as I remember? No. I think the seance scene is still magnificent. I think the scene where he uncovers the hidden room is still magnificent. And I think the sound design, appropriately for a movie about a composer, the sound design in this, although to modern audiences it may feel like, are we kind of been here, done that? Back when I watched it, I still think the sound is just incredible. Like, you know, it's got that very omen-y kind of sort of religious vibe to the music of it. But the sound design is great. And I said, when he uncovers the room and just you can hear the wind whistling through as he's pulling the planks off and stuff. I still really enjoyed it. And there was loads I hadn't remembered, really. I hadn't remembered all the detail about the kind of the evil senator. I hadn't remembered actually how good the very ending is. I'd remembered the silly bit where the ghostly wheelchair is kind of chasing everyone around. And you're kind of like, okay, this is a little daft. But actually, the very final moments where the house is burning, because that house was a real set. So it was a real set built on three floors. And actually, I'd not appreciated it, Brett, how tight the shots are. But then at the end, when kind of everything goes to shit, the camera does kind of pan out and you see
it comes
down the staircase. And that set allows them to do that. I loved watching it again for this because I'd not, it kind of delivered still what I remembered in my head, and there were plenty of clunky bits as well. But it also reminded me of stuff I'd forgotten. Like I say, how good that final scene where he's walking up the staircase and the wind's blowing him back.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's great. It's really great.
I think that's one of the things that Mark mentioned that I hadn't fully joined the dots on is that, yes, I'm aware that his kid and his wife have died, and he keeps seeing these, you know, he goes to his friend's house and the girl comes in and it looks like his daughter, and there's all of these instances, and, you know, the woman comes in, it looks like his wife. There's like those things that they don't build on it. They don't really go there with it. And this bit about, well, does he think it's his daughter coming back to see him? And the ball plays a massive part of that. Or is it just the malevolent ghost who's trying to get his attention so he can solve this murder? But yeah, I think until you mentioned it, Mark, I hadn't really appreciated that. There's that element to it where he's obviously thinking, the first time the ball comes, his daughter's ball that appears, he must be thinking, shit, the ghost of my daughter's here. That must be what he's thinking. But then that never materializes and it's something else completely. But the ball, Brett, scary ball?
Ball is absolutely massive. I mean, Mark mentioned the others. That's a very similar scene in the others, I think, isn't there? With a ball and stuff like that. But it's just been copied so many times. And I'm sure this must have been the first time that it was used in a film and stuff. And I think there's even one part where it's like wet, because obviously the kid's been in the bath and stuff like that. So like the attention to detail is like massive. I mean, I, to be honest, after what conversation, I'd like to watch it again. Loads of stuff that I've missed here and I haven't appreciated that. That's what I think. So it's got, you can watch it again and kind of miss stuff. You can take it on face value and think, well, like Mark says, it's a procedural in certain places and it's a ghost story and that's it. I think there's more going on. I think if you watch it again, especially after us three have just discussed it, do you know what I mean? I think there's more going on there for sure. And I think that's why these massive directors, Spielberg, Scorsese and stuff like that, appreciate it. Obviously, the scary bits, the seance bit and things like that, which is just wonderful. But I love films like that personally.
There's the famous ball bit in The Shining as well. And
it's
interesting you say this was shot in 78.
Mm-hmm.
So, because The Shining came out in 80 as well, so maybe this did it first. But it's the parallels between this and The Shining. There's loads of them, aren't there? And the ball bit in the Shining.
Well, he's on the trike, isn't he? And the twins isn't it? I think
he's sat on the carpet, and there's a and the
pack. Oh yes, carpet, that's it.
And the carpet. Have you guys seen Room 237?
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Really good.
Amazing. I love that movie, and that's. Uh-huh. Yeah, that shows that when the ball comes in, the pattern is open, and when he picks it up, the pattern closed on the carpet.
Yeah,
all this kind of crazy shit. But I couldn't figure out who had done what first. Like, I remember the ball from The Shining, to be honest with you, more than I remember the one from The Changeling. But then I watched The Changeling again. I sort of think I think this did it first. You know, it's a Canadian movie. There was a big deal in its home country. It won. Well, I think they're called the Genies or something. Whatever the Canadian
Genies, it won
Oscars
all of
are.
The Genies.
It won all of them. Like, you know, it was a big hit, but it came to the States and no one was that bothered. Presumably because they were exorcisted out, or they were the Shining out, and along came another one. And actually, I think it hasn't really grown in stature. Like I say, the big director guys love it. Guillermo del Toro. You know, apparently kind of almost accosted. He saw Peter Medak at a BAFTA event and kind of practically sort of jumped on him and said, you're my hero, you're my hero. You know, these guys revere him. You know, yeah. And it's bizarre. You hear about, you know, this is the director of, let's not forget, Species 2, you know, and Heart to Heart. Like, you know, but these guys are falling over them, you know, so, for an era. So it's amazing, really.
Do you think that there's like comparisons with Cork now with that type of thing as well? Because Cork now, obviously, I mean, me and you love him. You mentioned him at the start. I mean, he's my favourite film director. But he's never sort of regarded as a Spielberg or, you know, he's not in that league according to certain people because he's made, like, you know, Escape from Mars and, you know, stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's a similar type of thing. But again, with Cork now, after The Thing and stuff like that, he wasn't, he took what he was offered, basically. And those films are even great after The Thing. I love all those films. In fact, I love all these certain films.
But I wonder, apart from maybe, I'll tell you the one I think is poor, is Prince of Darkness, which I watched the other day. And I was just like, this is crap. But I love Carpenter. But I think the Carpenter's parallel is really valid because I think in the same way that The Thing got killed by E.T.,
yeah,
you know, E.T., everyone went mad for E.T., The Thing bombed. I kind of feel the same about The Changeling, is people sort of thought, you know, they'd done with The Thing and E.T., they felt they'd done their alien on Earth story and didn't bother with The Thing.
Yeah.
And with The Changeling, they felt they'd done their, I've paid my $10 to, well, it wouldn't mean $10 by then, but yeah, I've paid my dollars to see my Haunted House movie. Thanks very much. I'll move along. And I wonder if those guys, I mean, Medic's never been, and Carpenter is just consistently brilliant, I think, at what he does. And I know, you know, you go into a John Carpenter movie knowing what you're going to get in a way.
I know what you're going to see, because the look the same. That's the thing about Carpenter. You know that it's a John Carpenter film because you're watching it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's he's an auteur, right? That's what auteurs do. You know, it's the same with all of these, you know, modern auteurs or older ones. They have the same look and feel. You know, it's their film. That's what makes them, and that's why they have diehard fans rather than people that jump it in and out like this guy. Look at the films he's directed. No two of them are the same. Like, that's why you don't have that following as a director like the likes of Scorsese and stuff do.
But you mentioned Ghosts of Mars, which I actually really
do you like it?
I do really like it. But there's I'm sure there's a moment in it, and I think it's Pam Grier's head. But I've got a distinct, and I'm not even sure he's in it. It's Jason Statham's in it, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And in my head, my abiding memory of Ghosts of Mars is there's a shot of Jason Statham on the top of a hill, and he picks up Pam Grier's severed head, and he's obviously, like, you know, concerned about this. And I remember he radios back. He goes, "We got a situation here," and it's like, Jason, you do very much.
But the thing is that like the context of those films are so weird because John Carpenter is just taking the piss out of Hollywood and himself, and Escape from LA and Ghosts of Mars and stuff like that. So there's a certain context that you need to look through. But I mean, I've got nearly all of these films on Blu-ray and stuff like that. But I actually liked Ghosts of Mars when it first came out.
Yeah,
because,
me too.
You know, I was a massive John Carpenter fan. I'm going to have to revisit it. I tell you what, Mark. You're going to come back on and we're going to do Ghosts of Mars.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so we'll do that.
I've got one last thing I wanted to ask you guys is, do you know the movie? So, yeah, Trish Van Devere is George C. Scott's, well, technically she's his fifth wife.
Right.
But only because he married Colleen Dewhurst twice. So actually she's the fourth lady, but the fifth wife. Do you guys know the movie that they met on?
Well, I don't know. I'd never seen her in anything before, I don't think.
It would be a guess. It would be. And you're cheating.
It's a film I've never seen, but I've always, always wanted to watch just for the tagline. Mm-hmm. So the film that they met on is The Day of the Dolphin. And the tagline of that, have you guys seen The Day of the Dolphin?
No.
Do you know what?
I'm at the poster now.
Mark, I think I've done a quiz about this.
Oh, have you?
I think I have asked Cliff the very same question.
Oh, yes.
I'm like, it's great, isn't it? Go on, I'll let you do it.
The tagline is, unwittingly, that's the key word.
Unwittingly.
Unwittingly, he trained a dolphin to kill the President of the United States.
Yes.
How good a tagline is that?
He thought he was doing something else.
Yeah. he's unwittingly done it.
Yeah, yeah.
He thought he was convincing him to kill the president of Nigeria, and they just flicked the switch, and he's gone to the United States instead. Fucking GPS for you, isn't it?
It's Mike Nichols as well, that.
I know it's Mike Nichols. It's the most mental film. It's Mike Nichols directs George C. Scott, who, and like I say, I've never seen it, but yeah, I think he's a guy, he's a scientist who is figuring out how to communicate with dolphins. And I think clearly they sort of stick a torpedo on a dolphin's back and say, that way, Flipper. No, a bit left.
And somehow the Russians get involved. Somehow the Russians get involved and hack the tech. What a wonderful thought.
Amazing.
That sounds amazing.
Well, I haven't seen it, but maybe it's time I dig that out.
Can I just tell Mark a story? Because Cliff talks about you with incredibly high praise, Mark. He tells me all the stories that you tell him. Obviously, we'll not repeat the one here. But my wife got out of a disciplinary hearing by reciting one of your stories.
Amazing.
I don't know this.
She works for the NHS. She works for the NHS. Okay. She's the X-ray department and stuff like that. And she was off during the COVID and stuff like that. And I told her the story that Cliff told me about Brad Pitt or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she just completely defused the situation by going into the room with all of her bosses and just telling the whole story. We're like, it's absolutely fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's forgiven.
That is a true story. So I don't know what part he told you, but yeah, that was my third date with my now wife.
Yes, I think he embellished that it was the first date.
No.
So it was date three. So obviously it's the date where you're thinking, I'm getting some action here.
I've been here twice already.
Exactly. So I took her and we went, it was a party in it was the premiere of Kick-Ass, and I knew quite well the director, Matthew Vaughan, who's a really nice guy, and he obviously used to produce sort of Guy Ritchie's old movies and stuff. So he was a British guy who kind of we knew well from parties or whatever. And he said, oh, come to the premiere and come to my house for an after party, bring a plus one. Which is fucking unheard of in, you never get that shit. So I said to Kaz, like, let's go to this. And I knew who his wife was, but Kaz didn't. Uh-huh. So we go to the film, which I love, and Kaz loved. I knew she'd like it. And we pull up at his house in, I think it was like Notting Hill. Uh-huh. And his wife, who is Claudia Schiffer, answers the door. And Schiffer's massively pregnant. She's like, hiya, come on in. And Kaz is like, fucking, is that Claudia Schiffer? And then we go down and it's in his basement. Well, the party's kind of all over, but the bar is in the basement. Mm-hmm. And there's, Take That's there, who Kaz loves. So she was like, fucking hell, Take That. And all these, I'm trying to remember all the people, Aaron Taylor Johnson. Oh, yeah, all the Kick-Ass people there and blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And then in the corner, this guy in a fucking beanie hat, but he was in his kind of like weasel phase. He had this horrible beard. And we went, and she went, you have to make me meet Brad Pitt. So I kind of went over, and God love Matthew Vaughan for this. Uh-huh. He went, because it was just him and Brad Pitt stood there. So I took Paz over, and God love him. Matthew Vaughan went, oh, Brad, this is Mark. He's the editor of Empire magazine. And God love Brad Pitt for this. He went, man, it's my favourite fucking magazine. When me and Quentin were making Inglourious Basterds, it's all we read on set. And, honestly, I'm trying to get laid, so I'm like, thank you. You are a fucking genius. And then all I remember is Kaz, my now wife, just stuck her face. So I said, right, we're going to shoot off now. So I shook Matthew Vaughan's hand, shook Brad Pitt's hand. Kaz shook Matthew Vaughan's hand and then just stuck her face in front of Brad Pitt's mouth. And he sort of kissed her cheek because he had no other option. He just kissed her cheek. And that was it. And then obviously he... I emailed him and he wrote a letter. He was a very, very fine guy. Kaz didn't wash that cheek for months. Ridiculous.
And Brad Pitt is inadvertently getting people laid, isn't he? Just by his very presence.
Exactly.
Wonderful story. Absolutely, Kaz. He's inadvertently getting people out of discipline. I'm sure he did. He didn't consider that, did he? While he was doing it.
He is a benevolent man.
His influence is widespread.
Right, I don't think we can top that. So thank you, Mark, for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm sure we'll have you on again to talk about the Day of the Dolphin or Ghost of Mars, something like that. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Top man, Mark.
Sorry, no.
I'm really pleased to meet you. Honestly, top man.
Well, thank you. Look, honestly, the pleasure's all mine. Without a shadow of a doubt, it's my favourite podcast. I absolutely, like, every Saturday morning, I switch you guys on. It cheers me up after a long, difficult week. I love it. Absolutely love it. So the honour's all mine. Thank you very much. I love it.
Cheers, man.
I'd love to come back at some point.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep, that was a talk about the Changeling, John Carpenter, Brad Pitt, and all other things. We're going to play you out with some music from, how do you pronounce this, Brett? I don't get it right when it's easy. What's this band called?
You don't, do you? This is by Denny DePatchins.
Yeah, who is it?
No, it's not. It's by the Box Tellies.
Uh-huh. And it's called Do You Mind?
Do You Mind? Okay. Yes, that's right.
Right.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. Mark, you'll hear it on Saturday morning. Cheers, everyone, and see you later. Thanks very much, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I like you, you like me too. Let's get together. You like change, I might just stay the same, maybe forever. Let's hang out for a day. I'll take you to a play somewhere. We like the same thing sometimes. We like to sit and drink wine.
We like the Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.